Can you hear me in the back? Because I've got laryngitis today. Excellent. Thank you. My wife and son are very happy that I have voice problems. Well, good afternoon, and thank you very much for being with us today in Sacramento. My name is Wayne Bell, and I'm the relatively newly appointed real estate commissioner. Thank you. As most of you know, I was appointed on February 13th, and I was sworn in on February 15th. And I'm very fortunate to have been appointed by the governor. And I'm also enormously fortunate, privileged, honored, and truly grateful to have received the endorsement of the California Association of Realtors. Your support and advocacy was amazing. And I just want to tell you how deeply I appreciate your vital support and confidence. I also speak for myself and for the entire executive committee and my colleagues and coworkers at the Department of Real Estate when I tell you that we are all enhanced and enriched by the California Association of Realtors. You've been at the forefront of advancing professionalism and integrity in serving the public in real estate matters, and you've championed and promoted what we've done, and we thank you very much for that. The most recent example of CAR coming to the aid of the DRE, which, as you know, your predecessors helped form in 1917, can be found in Assembly Bill 429. That bill was sponsored by you to codify DRE's existing practice and longstanding practice of using its in-house counsel in doing administrative prosecutions. That bill and the specter of a statutory change led to the issuance of a letter from the California Attorney General authorizing the DRE and its successor, the Bureau of Real Estate, to continue its existing practice of using its own counsel until the end of June 30, 2015, with the expectation of renewals of that authorization. We thank you for this result, which would not have occurred without you. And again, I apologize for my voice. I usually don't sound like this, and so I really apologize. Before introducing our speakers and getting into our program for the day, which we hope is both educational and informative, I want to especially acknowledge my good friend, there's Pat, my colleague from the Business Transportation Housing Agency. Pat was our Deputy Secretary for Housing there, and she was a Provisional Undersecretary before I became a Provisional Undersecretary, and as you know, she was previously the President of the CAR, so I want to acknowledge my friend Pat. And then what I'd like to do is give you a brief overview and sort of a snapshot of what my work life looks like at the department at present. Okay. Actually, that's not it. There we go. That's it. And that's me with the hat right there. And while the drawing was meant to bring a smile to you, it also does capture and show you what we do and what we have to balance currently. After my appointment, I took a complete inventory of everything that we do at the department. And I could say that we currently have a large, changing, and expanding workload. Because the market appears to be changing, which is a great thing, we're seeing more examinations being scheduled. And for a long time, our examinations were down, our licenses were down, but we're seeing more examinations, and that will end up in more license applications. And then we had a backlog of some of our applications as well, and that caused us to have some overtime done so we could get those backlogs down. Then, in the subdivisions arena, you can imagine when the mortgage meltdown occurred and you saw a housing downturn, saw much, much less activity in the subdivisions arena. And because the market is turning around and there's lack of inventory, we're seeing subdividers come to us, and they're applying for new applications, they're applying for amended applications. And what Chris Neary tells me, Chris is right here, he'll be speaking with you later, we have a 40% jump from last year at the same time. And interestingly, we're looking at staff redirections as well. You probably know that when the governor's reorganization plan was put into effect, we had 342 staff statewide. We have five offices. We're going to have about 332 as of July 1, 2013, when we become a bureau. No one has lost their job. Some of the people who are in our administrative section in fiscal, HR, and a couple other areas have gone over to the Department of Consumer Affairs. And we will continue to do what we've always done in fiscal, in licensing, in enforcement, in subdivisions, in legal, and the consumer recovery account. So the programs that matter most to you will be unaffected, but we are going to have a few folks who have left the department and going over to the Department of Consumer Affairs. We also have seen a big increase in the number of consumer recovery account applications and payouts. In addition, we have a good number of routine and investigative audits, and we have a very large inventory, current inventory, of cases in our enforcement unit as well in our legal unit. Right now, we have about 3,500 cases sitting in the bucket of enforcement investigations, and then we have over 2,000 cases in our legal unit. Now, when we look at balance, it almost reminds me sometimes of those World War II movies that I've seen where you see the battleship battle group where someone's monitoring where everything is. And that's what we're doing. We're trying to monitor where the market is, where the applications are, where the needs are, and then we're shifting our resources as we can do that. In addition to balancing and juggling this workload, we're working on our transition to the Bureau. And we have a few other moving parts. For instance, as you know, when I last spoke with you in Monterey, we had no chief deputy. We now have a chief deputy, which is Jeff Mason here, who I will introduce in a moment. But Jeff Mason has joined us as of April 5th of this year. And then we still have no chief of enforcement. We're looking for someone to replace Bill Moran. Bill left in the end of December, and Tom Poole has graciously stepped up, and he's been acting as the chief of enforcement since Bill's departure. And then we have no chief counsel, because when I left, I was the chief counsel, but John Van Driel, who's on the far end over here, has graciously stepped up, and he's acting as our chief counsel. And then we have a couple of vacancies in our legal unit. Then there's the one final move that we have to focus on in Sacramento. We're actually moving our offices. And for those of you who are in Monterey, you'll remember I told you that we're moving our offices from space on Broadway here, a very old and tired space, to a newer office over by Cal Expo. And we'll have an examination center there. And the good thing about our move is once we have that examination center up and running, you're going to have electronic examinations in Sacramento, which will allow people to take the examination. And if they pass it, and if they've filed for an examination application and they pass, they'll be able to get their certificate that day. Then we'll be up throughout the state so that people can do electronic examinations in all five of our offices. Though we have a lot of things to juggle, the department's executive committee and I are focused on and committed to balancing our workload, streamlining and improving what we do, looking at better and smarter ways to conduct our work, managing the greatest risk to public protection, orchestrating all of the moving parts, most prudently assigning our limited resources, and endeavoring to ensure a competent, fair, and law-abiding marketplace. Moving forward and ultimately onto the agenda, I would like to take a moment and introduce you to my colleagues who are here with me today. Jeff Mason, who's to my left here, Jeff, if you raise your hand, is the newly appointed Chief Real Estate Commissioner. As I mentioned before, he was appointed by the governor on April 5th, 2013, and he came to the DRE from his position as Chief of the Bureau of Security and Investigative Services at the Department of Consumer Affairs. His experience includes legislative work with Assemblymember Denise Cicchini, private sector work with AT&T Wireless Services, and service as a hospital corpsman in the U.S. Navy. So if any of you have any aches or pains, he may be the guy to see. In addition, he's a really nice guy, and we're glad to have him. John Van Driel. Oh, yes. Excuse me. John Van Driel, to the far right, to my far right, is and has been acting chief counsel since my appointment as commissioner. He has been with the DRE for 25 and a half years, and his service has included work as a prosecuting attorney at all levels and handling all types of cases, the managing attorney over our consumer recovery account, and as assistant chief counsel for Northern California. John has been my go-to guy for all of our legal matters for a long time now, and his solid advice, hard work, breadth of knowledge, and advocacy skills are crucial to me and the department. Then we have Tom Poole. He's going to be giving our operations report, And I think most of you know Tom is our legislative advocate as well as our public information officer. Tom is at the far end down here. But he also manages our mortgage lending activities unit. And as I mentioned a moment ago, since Bill Moran's retirement, Tom has also been acting as our chief of enforcement and the manager of our licensing unit. His knowledge, experience, and cautious counsel is and has been invaluable to me and to the DRE. Now, Dan Sondry, and Dan is sitting right next to me here. I know you know Dan. He's our chief auditor, and he'll be giving our audit report, which includes information about a great new educational tool dealing with trust fund handling. Dan started with the DRE almost 25 years ago as an auditor one in our San Francisco office, and he is a consummate professional. At the CAR Capital reception the other night, I was asked if we would have anyone presenting today who was as funny as Fauci Lin. Well, I'm not certain if Dan honed his skills in the comedy clubs in the Bay Area or not, but I can assure you that Dan can attain the pinnacle of humor that Fauci once had. Our last presenter is Chris Neary, who's sitting next to Dan Sondry. And he's our assistant commissioner for subdivisions. And I'm not certain if he has any one-liners or hidden humor in his presentation on our subdivisions program. In fact, I don't know how much you can find that's very funny in our subdivisions program. But Chris has been with the DRE for 23 years, and all of his service has been in the subdivisions unit. His knowledge about the Subdivided Lands Law and the Vacation Ownership and Timeshare Act is unparalleled. At our last forum in Monterey, we promised you a presentation from Chris on subdivisions, including the public report process, common violations, and what you need to know about selling subdivision interests. And you will get that today. And then I have two final introductions, and then I'll move forward into the program itself. At the last forum, you were introduced to Ro Bodendistel, and Ro's right in front of me here, who works in our executive office, and she helps support all of us. She provides us with great, great assistance, and she has been kind enough to help us again for this forum today, and I want to thank Ro for being here. We also have Ginger Allison, and Ginger is sitting next to Ro in the front row there, and she's been serving as my assistant now for several months, and I cannot thank her enough for all that she does. She's got a wonderful attitude, a high energy, creativity, and she always provides professional work. In addition, she spent long, long hours putting together the presentations slides that you'll see today. Now, the time allotted for our presentation is 1 hour and 50 minutes. And I can tell you that I think we're going to have time. I want to have time left over so that you can ask any questions that you have, so we can have a discussion, because I think that's really important. What I want to do is have more interaction between you and us so we know what you're seeing in the industry, so we can answer any questions you have, we can pose questions to you. And then as part of any give and take, what I'd really like to know is what we can do to improve our services, what we can do to add value, be more helpful to you, and be more relevant in serving the public. Now, I'm not certain how much time we're going to have, but we'll stay over if we have to. At this point, I'd like to invite my good friend and colleague, Tom Poole, up, who's going to give you the operations report. Tom?
Thank you, Wayne. My name is Tom Poole. I've been with the department 28 years, as Wayne said, that I've worn a lot of different hats in the department. I continue to wear a lot of different hats in the department, and I'm grateful for the appointment of Wayne. And Wayne didn't really talk about his past, but he's the first commissioner to be appointed from the inside. He was our chief counsel since 2006. That means he's been hitting the ground running, if I can use that term, and he told you he lost his voice because of allergies, and I'm here to tell you that's not the case. It's because he's been yelling at everybody to try to get up to speed. Today, I have the distinct privilege of providing the operations report. Today, I'm going to be talking about our fiscal overview. That includes our revenues, our expenditures, and our reserves. It paints a pretty interesting picture, and then I'm going to go into a little bit of the workload that we're experiencing in licensing, enforcement, and subdivisions. And I'm going to try to tie in how those workloads tie into our revenue and kind of the picture it paints going forward. We are in a fiscal year that starts from July 1st and ends on June 30th, which means that we just finished our third quarter that ended March 31st. So when I bring up these graphs and pictures and charts, I tried to do it in a year over year, so you're going to be seeing charts that reflect the first three quarters of last year and then the first three quarters of this year, so we can get a picture of where we're going. So let's start with a fiscal comparison. What you see, or perhaps can't see if you're way over here, we have two sets of graphs. That's right. We do have handouts in the back that do reflect some of the things that I'm talking about, so it may be helpful to grab those. But what we have here is a fiscal comparison for the first three quarters of last fiscal year to now. Now, the one on the left-hand side represents last fiscal year. The bronze color, the gold color chart or the bar that you see there is revenues. You can see that we had about $30 million in revenues last year at this time, and that's increased. Well, it's $32.5 million, and it's been increased to $35.5 million. That's a 9% increase year over year, and we expect that to continue. The beige bar in the middle is expenditures, and what you see in expenditures, they're also going down considerably. In fact, they went down approximately 6% year over year. So the first two things are very good. Revenue is up. And the reason revenue is up, we have four major revenue generators. That's exam fees, license fees, MLS endorsement fees, and subdivision fees. All four of those categories are up year over year. Expenditures are down. We had some major expenditures last year that we're not incurring this year. That's the reason it's down. So what has it done to our reserves? Well, reserves are up. And that is represented by the blue bar. And our reserves are about just a hair over 22% in terms of an increase. To paint a little clearer picture, this is a chart showing our the first 9 months of revenue, along with the 9 months of expenditure and along with the increase in reserves. You can see we started the fiscal year at $25.8 million. Currently we have $31.4 million, which is an increase in reserves of $5.66 million. And that's going to continue. What that all means for you is I don't see any kind of... if we were going to ask for an increase in... I think licensing fees, we'd call it an enhancement or perhaps a revenue adjustment. But I'm going to say there's going to be no need to increase your license fees in the near term. All right? All right. So let's tie this into how the workload and revenue tie in. Let's start with licensing. And again, licensing is a mainstay within the department in terms of what we do. Licensing, obviously, does the exams, and that exam is supposed to make sure there's a minimum level of competency. And when you look at this chart, let's go left to right. We have gold and blue. For those Cal or UCLA fans, and my boss is a UCLA fan, so he made me pick these colors. The gold is the first three quarters of last year, and these are reflective in one of the handouts. The blue is the first three quarters of this year. So you can see that we went from last year about 16,700 exams for the first three quarters. That's up to 19,084 the first three quarters. That's about a 14% increase year over year. We go to real estate brokers exam scheduled. Again, we have a fairly substantial increase from about 7,000 up to 8,500. So real estate brokers exams year over year is about 1,500. That's a 22% increase. Going to original licenses, salesperson's licenses issued. The next bar over, last year at this time we had about 8,600. Now we have over 9,000. That's about a 4.7 increase year over year. Same with the broker licenses issued. We're up over 190 licenses year over year. That's a 4.2% increase. And then the aberration in the group is real estate sales exam or real estate salesperson's renewals. We're actually down. We had 36,630 renewals last year. We're down to 34,845, which is about a decrease of about 4.8%. And I really spent some time trying to think of why this is so. And I thought, well, these people got their licenses 4 years ago, which puts in about 2009. We've had a pretty rough stretch of it. So I imagine a lot of these salespeople decided to go on and do something else. But when you look at broker renewals, they are up. We had 19,500 last year, and we're up over 733, or 3.7%. So just in this one snapshot, you can see why our revenues are up, just because across the board, for the most part, our workloads are up in applications and actual licenses. So what has this done to our licensee population? You can see that in 2007-2008, we peaked at 542,000. That was the peak. Actually, a few months before that, end of the fiscal year, we almost reached 550,000 licensees, which worked out to about one licensee for every 51 adults in California, but I didn't have to tell you that. And then we had a steady decrease every single year to now. And now currently that we have 413,000. That's really as of today. What's interesting thing about that number, if you go back about 4 or 5 months, we've been bouncing between about 412,000 and 415,000. It's just kind of bouncing. So I think we've hit the bottom in terms of the licensee population. So I expect you saw the exams in the previous chart are going up, and I think there's going to be more people entering into the business, and I think we're going to start seeing this total licensee population going up in the near term. The other type of license that we issued are the mortgage loan originator endorsements. Many of you have heard me talk about this in terms of my ledge capacity and also overseeing the mortgage loan activity section. The mortgage loan endorsements, mortgage loan originator endorsements started about 2 or 3 years ago pursuant to SB 36. If you're going to originate mortgage loans that are secured by 1 to 4 residential units, you need an endorsement through your license. This is what this is reflecting. Last year, we had about 26 MLO endorsees. We currently have about 24,000. So that number has dropped slightly. A couple interesting facts about the MLO endorsement. It's an annual license. You have to renew it once a year. So it's not something you can kind of put on ice. If you're going to be in a business, you're going to want to renew it. The other part about it, it costs $300 to obtain and $300 to renew. That's compared to a $300 for a four-year broker license. So this actually, when this is, we started issuing these in 2011, has enhanced our revenues significantly, and a lot of the money is gone to trying to bolster our enforcement efforts. I don't have to tell you that a majority of our enforcement efforts have been in the mortgage loan arena and have been and continue to be. And what we've seen, I'm going to show you in a minute another slide in terms of our enforcement outcomes, is that in recent years, most of our effort has gone to loan modification fraud, which is a component of the mortgage lending. And interestingly enough, a lot of the efforts that we've undertaken, both on administrative level and trying to cooperate with law enforcement on this, has been in the mortgage lending arena. So this is actually a good component. It brings revenue to the department and helps. So here are the enforcement results. I decided to just compile all of this. I don't know if you can see it too terribly well, but I'm going to break it down for you. This chart shows what the effort, the end result of the efforts of our audit section, our legal section, and our enforcement section, and our investigators. This is the end game. The second to last column on the right talks about the results of the fiscal year of 11-12. It was a significant year for us in a number of ways. If you add up the first four columns there, or the first rows, you're looking at license surrenders, revocations, suspensions. And if you add those up, you're looking at a record number last year of 1,106 revocation, suspensions, surrenders. We have never even come close to that in years past. And one number, I wanted to use this, so I have to. This number right here talks about desist and refrain orders. The DNRs, and it does not mean do not resuscitate, it means desist and refrain, that the DNR orders that we issue primarily go to unlicensed individuals. We do issue desist and refrain orders against licensees for some sort of aberrant behavior or wrongdoing, saying stop this behavior. But a majority of them are for unlicensed individuals. What we've experienced over the last number of years is unlicensed individuals jumping into the market to provide some sort of mortgage or foreclosure relief. They collect illegal advance fees. They do little or nothing in the way of services. They collect the money and disappear. That loan modification service requires a real estate broker's license. That's how we get in to investigate. So that record number of 213 desist and refrain orders is really a reflection of not what all of you are doing, but in fact what a number of unlicensed persons and entities. So let's jump to that last column in gold, and that's the reflection of the first three quarters of this year. And there's some interesting numbers in here. If you add up again the surrenders, revocations, and suspensions, we have a total of 795 for the first 9 months of this year. If we were to project that out, you're looking at 1,060 actions. That's near record. And we still may have a push here towards the end and exceed that. We've currently issued 134 desist and refrain orders. That projects out to about 178. As Wayne said, we still have a lot of inventory in our legal and enforcement section. So what this chart is telling you is we've been very busy. Our enforcement efforts have been very robust. But what Wayne was talking about earlier is, as busy as we've been, maybe there's a way that we can shuffle the deck to make sure that we're getting the most bang for the buck in terms of our enforcement effort. But this is a nice snapshot of what everybody's been doing up here. I want to go into the subdivision next. This will be the last thing I'm going to talk about. The subdivision comparison. Chris is going to get into some detail about what subdivision does and your responsibility in terms of selling homes in a subdivision, how to counsel clients that are buying into a new subdivision. But these numbers tell us a lot. For those of you who don't know, that when a subdivider wants to bring something to market, first thing they do is go to the locals. They get their map approved pursuant to the Subdivided Map Act. They get their map done. They get all the infrastructure done. Then they come to the Department of Real Estate, in essence, to get a permit to sell. That permit is in the form of a public report. They submit an application to us. We actually do the vetting for the consumer to make sure things that in the public report disclose what a consumer needs to know about that subdivision. They talk about the CC&Rs, the assessments, if projects include swimming pools and other types of common interests that aren't done yet, what the protections are to make sure those get done. So it plays an extremely important role in the process. That final permit that is issued is called a final public report, and it's represented by this blue column here. Last year at this time, we had issued 1,449 final public reports. This year at the same time, we're up to 1,475. That's a 40% increase year over year. And it's just continuing. Chris can talk about it a little bit, but the number of applicants are going up. What does that mean? Well, that means is developers are putting the spades in or the shovels in the ground. They're starting to break ground. This means more units are going to be coming up for sale. The green column talks about the number of renewals that were done. Public reports have a shelf life. They do expire. If there's still unsold units, developers come back to get that public report renewed so they can continue to sell. Those are up slightly from 272 up to 304. And then the yellow is the amendments. If something significant or material changes during the selling process, the developer has to stop sales and come back to us and amend that public report to make sure it reflects accurately what's going on. Amendments are way down, and that's a good thing. That means these projects are getting sold out. So it looks really good. I want to give you a 7-year comparison. You can see here back in the heyday of 05-06, we issued over 4,500 public reports. That represented tens and tens of thousands of homes that were coming. And then what happened, the market crashed, and you can see the number of applicants just go down, 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 down. And we've really been kind of bouncing along the bottom for the last few years. But we're seeing the uptick. And one thing that we recognize, not only the applications coming in, but our revenues are up in this area as well. So when you look at the fiscal picture, when you look at the workload that we're starting to see within the department, I think all indicators are that we're really poised for a recovery. And I know that in certain parts of California where we're starting to see things pick up, but the more units we can get in, that should help with the inventory going forward. So it paints a very rosy, optimistic picture. I'm just going to keep my fingers crossed and hope that we can continue this. So that ends my operations update and report. At this point, I want to introduce my good friend Dan. And I started back in the San Francisco office almost 25 years ago. And so I've known him a long time, and it's my privilege to introduce Dan Sandry, our chief auditor.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom. Appreciate it. And good afternoon, everyone. Thanks. I'm going to ask you to also bear with my voice. I'm not that bad off, but essentially I just want to be like Wayne. So, okay. As you know, in audit examinations, we are focused on trust fund handling. For a broker who is the subject of an audit, success or failure often hinges on whether there's an appropriate record-keeping system in place and whether the broker has established a proper system of review for compliance with the law. In other words, record keeping and broker supervision are critical. First, I want to give you a brief overview of the types of audits we closed in calendar year 2012. As you can see, 69% of the 836 audits completed last year were investigative audits, while 31% were routine examinations. Last year's 31% figure for routine audits is a high percentage, reflecting our emphasis on performing routine audits of licensees who handle a large volume of trust funds. This emphasis was enabled by a streamlining of audit procedures, including preparation of more short-form audit reports whenever possible. Looking at the activities of the audits closed in 2012, property management audits comprised 39% of the audits, followed by mortgage loan audits and resale audits, both at 27%. If we were to show the percentages for routine audits, the sales audits would virtually disappear and the audits would consist of property management, mortgage loan, and broker escrow audits, as those are the types of audits with the greater risk for trust fund mishandling. Okay, to properly demonstrate the importance of record keeping, I'm going to discuss the top 5 violations found on DRE audits in 2012. As you know, accounting and record keeping are extremely exciting subjects, and the people like me who are involved in it can be riveting. For example, there's the following story. A lady goes to see her doctor with some very worrisome symptoms. After examining her, he says, "I'm terribly sorry to tell you this, but you have only 6 months left to live." The lady is very distraught. "Oh, doctor, what should I do?" she asks. The doctor says, "I advise you to marry an accountant." Will that make me live longer? She asks, hopefully. No, says the doctor, but it will seem longer. Okay. So, 2012 was not unlike previous years in terms of where the violations were. The top five violations each related to trust fund handling and trust fund record keeping. However, if the broker does not review and supervise, I've got to go backwards. Okay. If the broker does not review and supervise, it doesn't matter how accurate the trust account records are or how timely trust funds are deposited. These funds will be vulnerable. Furthermore, compliance with record keeping and trust fund handling laws will not take place if the broker does not oversee things. So here are the top five violations, audit violations of 2012, starting with number five. And the number five violation on audits is Commissioner's Regulation 2831.1, which requires a separate accounting record for each beneficiary transaction. The typical example is for a property manager handling trust funds through a trust account, that there is a separate accounting record for each property owner or for each property. Noncompliance with this regulation is usually related to incomplete or inaccurate separate records. Separate records must have the detail referenced in Regulation 2831.1A. For example, each record must have a daily running balance and contain all the relevant transactions for the beneficiary. Sometimes this violation is cited if a broker fails to account for unidentified funds, which are funds in the trust account whose ownership is not known. So if you lose track of who owns certain funds in the trust account, you need to set up a separate record and label it as unidentified funds and handle them as trust funds and not your own funds. A Regulation 2831.1 violation was cited on 21% of all audits in 2012. Okay, the fourth most common violation on 2012 audits was Commissioner's Regulation 2831.2, Trust Account Reconciliation. And this is a monthly reconciliation of the record of all trust funds received and dispersed with the sum of the balance of the separate records for each beneficiary. You need to do your monthly reconciliation between the accounting records and the bank statement, and then you perform this required reconciliation. And this audit was cited on 24% of all audits in 2012. The third most common violation was Commissioner's Regulation 2831, the record of all trust funds received and dispersed. And this is the columnar glorified checkbook record that accounts for all money in and out of the trust account. This record must be in chronological order and have all the required detail in Regulation 2831. And this violation was cited on 26% of all audits in 2012. The second most common violation in 2012 audits was Commissioner's Regulation 2832, which deals with trust fund handling. And, you know, these are regulations of Mr. Bell here, so you obviously want to comply with them. They're very important to him. Okay, so this regulation requires that if trust funds are not sent to escrow or placed into the hands of the principal to whom they belong, they must be deposited into the broker's trust account within 3 business days. Proper designation of the trust account is often the issue. We look to the bank signature card to make sure the account is properly designated as a trust account. And this violation was cited on 28% of all audits in 2012. And the number one violation found in 2012 audits was, not surprisingly, Business and Professions Code Section 10145, Handling of Trust Funds. Similar to Regulation 2832, which details it, Section 10145 requires that trust funds be placed into 1 of 3 places in a timely manner. It is also cited when trust accounts are improperly set up as interest-bearing accounts. This violation was cited on 44% of all audits done in 2012. So from the top five violations list, you can see the importance of trust fund record keeping and handling. And I have a recent audit case to demonstrate how record keeping can fail, especially when there's a lack of broker oversight. And this was a case of a broker who was a property manager and managed 265 properties for about 260 owners. And this broker collected approximately $6.5 million in trust funds, namely rents and security deposits annually. All these properties were managed through a single trust account, and the broker was the only signatory on the account. So that's great, you know. But there was also a signature stamp. And the two others who had access to it, and two other people had access to it. So that's not great. Let's see where we're going. The audit was scheduled, then delayed by the broker on the Friday before the Monday appointment. This can be a sign that there are problems at the audit site. So, and then on the day of the audit, our auditor was met at the entrance conference by the broker and the broker's attorney. And this one was one of those audits that starts with the attorney saying, "Miss Auditor, before you get started, Mr. Broker has something he wants to tell you." The broker explained that in the middle of preparation for the audit, the office manager, who I'll call Mr. PM, had confessed to him that he had been borrowing trust funds from the trust account. When the broker asked how much he had taken, Mr. PM said that he did not know. The attorney stated that unknown to the broker, Mr. PM had a gambling problem. And I could do a whole nother speech on with lots of stories about how gambling with trust funds is always a losing proposition. So to give you a little background, Mr. PM was a trusted family friend of the broker and had been hired some 10 years ago. The bookkeeper of the business was a relatively new employee who was always suspicious of the excuses Mr. PM gave her for not providing bank statements or deposit slip copies to her. The problem was she knew how close Mr. PM and the broker were and felt that Mr. PM was her boss. She didn't want to lose her job by complaining. Mr. PM was supposed to be in charge of the business account, and the bookkeeper was supposed to be in charge of the trust account. But it didn't work out that way. Mr. PM hid documents from the bookkeeper, insisted on collecting rents in person, and insisted on making deposits to the trust account, and could get the signature stamp from the bookkeeper's unsecured desk at any time. When the bookkeeper asked for bank statements, Mr. PM told her that the broker's outside accountant had them, and that this accountant was the one doing bank reconciliations for the trust account, even though this duty was in the bookkeeper's job description. When the bookkeeper asked for deposit slip copies, Mr. PM would claim that he lost it or that it was in his car, and eventually she stopped asking. So what were the results of this audit? The audit revealed a trust fund shortage of $313,268 as of February 28, 2011. And the shortage was due to, first of all, there are bank charges of over $2,147 with no bank statements. The bookkeeper did not know that these charges were being incurred. There were negative owner balances of nearly $39,000. The majority of these negatives, $35,755 of them, related to one property where Mr. PM would visit the property site monthly, collect the cash rents from the tenants, and keep the money, and then he'd come back to the office and issue a handwritten monthly check to the property owner from the trust account using old check stock that he had not thrown away when the company converted over to an electronic check writing system. Mr. PM told the bookkeeper that the tenants were writing their rent checks directly to the property owner. She had nothing to worry about. Checks written from the trust account to the broker's business account were the causes of $72,100 of the shortage. According to Mr. PM, in 2010, the operating expenses of the business began to exceed income, and Mr. PM said he did not have the heart to tell the broker, as the broker is having health issues. So Mr. PM began to move money from the trust account to the business account via checks written. Our auditor found 20 checks improperly written from the trust account to the business account beginning in 2009. Another cause of the shortage was, of course, embezzlement by Mr. PM. Our auditor identified a minimum of $110,614 that was taken by Mr. PM, not including the money taken that was part of the negative owner balance. More information on this, on how money was embezzled, in just a minute. Finally, there was $89,509 in causes of shortage that we did not identify. It's likely that embezzlement played a role in some or most of this, but we did not dig into this for the sake of efficiency and getting the audit done. Here's a little more detail as to how Mr. PM embezzled funds. I mentioned this previously, but Mr. PM collected and kept cash rents, and these monies never made it to the bookkeeper. Some of this led to a large negative balance, the large negative owner balance that I discussed before. Mr. PM also took cash out of deposits that the bookkeeper had prepared to the tune of over $68,000. The bookkeeper would prepare deposit slips and give the checks and the cash to Mr. PM. On the way to the bank, he would take out the cash, rewrite a deposit slip for the checks only, and have those deposited to the trust account. He would then conveniently lose the deposit slips. And finally, he forged the broker's signature both by hand and with the signature stamp and wrote checks to himself totaling over $37,000. Okay, so what enabled Mr. PM to take trust funds in this case? A major factor was that there was no separation of duties in the broker's shop. Whenever possible, a business needs to separate money collection from record keeping and from deposits in order to prevent the ability to steal funds and then hide the theft through false accounting. Mr. PM was able to collect rents, write checks out of the account, control the bank statements, and handle the deposits. He prevented proper bookkeeping from taking place. The result was that there was a money handling free-for-all with no checks and balances in place. And the bookkeeper could have stolen receipts too or written checks to herself if she had been so inclined. Since proper record-keeping was prevented, the lack of bank statements, receipts, and check copies kept the bookkeeper from seeing money being stolen. You almost wonder what work the bookkeeper did do there. And the broker might not have detected the missing funds should he have chosen to review the records. All of this was possible because the broker did not supervise. Records were not reviewed, and there was no system in place to separate duties and monitor compliance. So what was the end result of this audit case? The broker fired Mr. PM and filed a report with the Sheriff's Department. Mr. PM received a sentence of 5 years probation. The bookkeeper deposited over $320,000 of his own funds into the trust account to cure the shortage. Likely due in large part to this mitigating factor, his broker's license was revoked with the right to a restricted license, albeit with heavy terms, including but not limited to paying for costs of the prior audit and a follow-up audit, as well as the investigative and legal costs that he owed to DRE. The broker was also required to take a trust fund handling course. Surprise. Okay. Yeah, moving on. To summarize, the trust fund shortages found on DRE audits in 2012. Audit cases found nearly $5.2 million in shortages, and here are the numbers broken down by activity of the real estate broker. Property management mortgage loan, in particular private money mortgage loan operations, and broker escrow activities tend to be the highest risk activities in terms of trust fund loss. So we have many resources related to trust fund handling and record keeping on the DRE website to educate and assist real estate brokers. We have many real estate bullets and articles. As far as publications, we have the Broker Compliance Evaluation Manual, which a broker can use as a self-checkup of his or her office compliance. There's the Trust Funds Booklet, which is a detailed excerpt from the Trust Funds chapter of the Real Estate Reference Book. And, of course, you have the Real Estate Law Book and the Real Estate Reference Book. And you can also find trust fund accounting forms on the DRE website. And this you can barely see, but there it is. A snapshot from our webpage, and shows that under the publications section of our website, you can find the real estate bulletins and the audit forms. Audit forms are in the bottom section. And you can find the broker compliance evaluation manual and the trust fund booklet on the website. So here's a listing of some of the trust fund related real estate bulletin articles. For example, there was an article on trust fund handling in the electronic age recently. In fall 2008, another topic was trust fund withdrawals. And by withdrawals, I don't mean that you start shaking badly when you're away from trust funds for too long. There's many articles on trust fund handling and separation of duties and others. So check them out. And there are more resources coming to the website. We are currently working on narrated PowerPoint presentations on topics such as how to reconcile your records and your accounts, and how to set up a trust account, and other topics will be coming too. And those will be narrated by our auditors. So, in short, I would love to hear from you about other topics that you would like to see covered on our website. So call me or send me an email, and I'll see what we can get done. Thank you, and now I'm going to introduce to you our Assistant Commissioner in charge of subdivisions, Mr. Chris Neary.
Thank you, and it's good to be back. I think 2010 was the last time I spoke. I just have to ask Dan, are you an accountant? Because that seemed a little longer than normal. Just kidding, Dan. Just kidding, Dan. A lot has happened in the last 3 years since I've last been here. The market has turned. We've hit the bottom, and we're starting to come out of what some have termed the greatest downturn ever. We're seeing the subdivision numbers rise dramatically, 40% year over year, as Tom mentioned. We expect, and from my conversations with developers, the Irvine Company down in Orange County, they expect hundreds of projects to come through the door. We haven't seen them yet. They're still in mapping. But over these past years, subdividers have just been buying up land. They've been holding it, and now they're ready to go. So if anybody in the room is involved in subdivision sales, stay tuned. There's some things you need to know, and I'll take questions at the end. The first slide is the Subdivision Map Act. This is the body of law that we do not have jurisdiction over. This is done at the local level, and this allows the locals to put their stamp on the project, have it developed the way they see fit. The conditions of map approval, those are key elements to the mapping process. That's what requires the subdivider to do certain things, install certain improvements that the city wants to see in place. And then, again, the objective of the whole Subdivision Map Act process is to put the community stamp on the subdivision. The Subdivided Lands Law, that's where we have our jurisdiction. And it's to protect the purchasers from misrepresentation, deceit, and fraud in subdivision sales. And there's two aspects to that. There's affirmative standards and the disclosure in the public report. Now, the affirmative standards, this is really where we do our work. This is where we earn our paychecks. This is behind the scenes before we issue the public report. We want to make sure that the subdivision in question is suitable for use. And by use, I mean residential use. Vehicular access, potable water, available utilities, off-site improvements, just a few of the items that are required before we'll issue a public report. Oftentimes, we'll see a project come through the door and they don't have legal access to the property. Well, that's grounds for denial and subdividers out of luck. If the process wasn't in place, there may be harm to consumers by selling a lot or a unit where they simply can't access it. Fair dealing, the other aspect of affirmative standards, we're looking at securing the buyer's deposit. We want to make sure that whatever they put in escrow, they can get out of escrow should the subdivider run. Release of blanket encumbrances, conveyance of proper title, again, securing the purchaser's securing that property. Completion of common areas, another critical point and something that we're required to do by statute. The subdivider cannot close that escrow unless it's complete, or he has a bond in place to make sure it's completed. Disclosure, this is the other component of our process. This is the public report. The consumer must be provided the public report prior to signing the binding contract. And you'll see some items listed there, present and future costs, hazards, environmental issues, unusual restrictions. The report's going to be different. It's going to be different for every project. So that's not an all-inclusive list. This is very important because if you're out there securing a subdivision sale and there's no public report, you need to know why there is no public report. There has to be an intent to offer. Five or more lots or units, improved or unimproved. They can be vacant lands. The lands can be contiguous or non-contiguous. Generally, if they're non-contiguous, they're in close proximity to the other lands. It's a residential focus, and these are lands located in the state of California. We have numerous exemptions. The primary exemption is the five or more. If you have four lots, four units, it's not subject to the subdivided lands law. The next exemption, standard subdivisions. These are subdivisions within city limits with no common interest component. They're also completed structures. So that's a very common exemption that will be used by subdividers throughout the state. The next three are pretty self-explanatory: commercial industrial property, public agency lands, Caltrans land, and then bulk sales, builder-to-builder sales are exempt from the public report. Different types of subdivisions. The standard, as I mentioned, has no common interest component to it. And then we have the common interest developments. This is where the majority of our work is done. Probably 90 to 95% of the filings are common interest. And the top two are the headliners, condominium and planned developments, very few stock co-ops or community apartments. Undivided interest, we see more of those in the Bay Area, a lot of tenancy in common projects, but generally speaking, condos and PDs. Subdivision subtypes. Master planned offerings are the large, large communities. You'll generally have one, two, three, or four homeowners associations. They're generally speaking 500 lots or greater. And they'll be in the larger suburban settings for the most part. Continuing care subdivisions. That's a relatively new add to our jurisdiction. It's where a health care component is mixed with the subdivision. And as you can see, there's regulations associated with a few of these. Hotel condominiums are relatively new as well. It's basically a hotel that they've subdivided. And you're selling a hotel unit. There are generally restrictions on the amount of occupancy. It's generally 30 days or less because the local government wants the transient occupancy tax. Mobile homes, there's a few of those out there. Tenancy and commons, I mentioned those. Mixed-use subdivisions are becoming more and more common in cities throughout the state. We're seeing them in the Valley, whereas before they used to just be in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and the urban areas of South State. And then condominium conversions, those have been around forever. The different types of public reports. The preliminary, or sometimes called the pink report, allows you to advertise the property and take reservation money. The reservation money is a non-binding agreement. Either party can cancel at any time. And it gives the subdivider an opportunity to test the market. So they can get a feel for how sales are going to go. But at the same time, it protects the buyer's purchase money. Everything goes into a neutral escrow. The conditional public report is another tool the subdivider might use. It's a report that allows you to sign binding contracts but not close those contracts. There's some condition that's outstanding that hasn't been met yet. So if you're holding sales and you see a report on yellow paper and it's marked conditional, you know that you can't close that escrow until you get the final. And the final, of course, is the holy grail of reports. It's the white report, and typically issued for a term of 5 years, and that allows you to open and close escrows. It does everything for you. Any one of these reports can be amended or renewed. Phasing. Subdividers will do phasing for a number of reasons, but to have a true phasing or true phase for DRE purposes, it's one in which you're not collecting assessments beyond that particular phase. So if you're selling in phase one, assessments will commence on that phase. Phases 2 through 10, for example, they wouldn't commence until a sale is made in that particular phase. Phasing is accomplished through a simple declaration of annexation. Subdivider will record these, one per phase. And the subdivider will do the phasing primarily to delay the commencement of assessments. It can be quite a burden upon the subdivider to have all of the assessments commence at one time. In addition to that, completion of common area, if the subdivider were to bring a huge rec facility in phase one, you'd have a relatively small number of units paying for a large facility. So they want to bring that rec facility in at a later phase to kind of spread the pain of the assessment over a larger number of units. Rental programs, another reason why you might phase. If the market turns, you might go to rental for some of your later phases. I would imagine the existing homeowners are not too happy about that, but subdividers have this right. And then, of course, de-annexation of a phase. If you're phasing the project, it hasn't actually been legally brought on. So at any point, you could de-annex. You could change your product type. You could make it a separate subdivision altogether. It just gives more flexibility to the subdivider. This may be hard to see from back in the room, but this is a typical phasing map. And you can see the shaded gray areas. Those are lines separating the three different phases. The one complicating factor that might exist in this particular project, since we have three phases and one street running through them, is that that street is one lot. And so when we look at something like this, we're asking for the entire street to be provided to the HOA up front and completed, or they provide some financial security to make sure that it is completed for the later phases. There's no guarantee that all the phases must be completed. So that's the key component here. But we want the HOA to be made whole by owning the street. Another part of our review is the purchase contract, and this goes to the fair dealing for the consumer. We have a number of regulations and statutes that speak to what needs to be included in the purchase contract. Number one amongst that would be blanket encumbrances. There can be zero blanket encumbrances on the property, so there's a clause that covers that. Purchase money handling, I mentioned that earlier. We want to make sure that the buyer is made whole. So if things go sideways and the subdivider is not able to deliver, purchase money funds are guaranteed. Liquidated damages, again, if escrow doesn't close, there's provisions that we make sure are included. And then incentive clauses. Let's say the subdivider is going to install landscaping or a carpet allowance. Anything that's offered as an incentive, generally speaking, has to be guaranteed by the subdivider. They can't promise the new Mercedes and deliver it after the close of escrow without some guarantee, usually in the form of a bond or a letter of credit or something of that nature. Another big component of our review is budgets. Since most of our reviews are on common interest developments, the review of the budget is critical. A developer will want to keep the budget low, obviously to help his sales. We have to make sure that the budget is adequate to fund the operations of the HOA over an extended period of time. So we're looking at the operating and reserve expenses. We're looking at, in a conversion project, we're looking at each of the reserve components, roof component, swimming pool, whatever it might be, and we're aging that. So that will bump up the assessment in a common interest development depending on the age of that component. If it's a 20-year-old project and the roof's never been replaced, we're going to require 100% of those funds be deposited into escrow or the assessment reflect that. And the assessment in that case would be probably well over $1,000 a month. We also want to know the division between HOA and homeowner maintenance. The push for subdividers is to go with complete homeowner maintenance. They don't want the HOA to take on the maintenance because there's liability and lawsuits involved with that. So we make sure that it makes sense. In an attached row product, the developer may want roof and insurance and everything else to be homeowner responsibility. That's where DRE says no. It's got to be an HOA expense. Special assessments, if there's large delinquencies in assessments, we take note of that. We'll place a note in the special report and let the consumer know before they purchase that there's a likelihood of a special assessment. And then common problems with HOA budgets, as I mentioned, setting the budget too low is the primary problem that we see. Also in the budget review process, we want to know what the common area is when it's conveyed to the HOA. And site inspections, we do site inspections primarily on condo conversions. But whenever we receive a complaint, we'll do a site inspection. And then restarting the HOA and the impact on reserves. For the broken projects we've seen lately, the reserves are typically non-funded. So we have to take that into account when we're issuing an amended report. HOAs, they can be either incorporated or unincorporated. Management documents, CC&Rs, bylaws, articles of incorporation, and then contracts with the HOAs, that could be a shared use agreement between two HOAs that sit side by side. Maybe they share a driveway. We review those. Maybe a laundry contract that's entered into by the subdivider on behalf of the HOA. I'm not going to go through this whole list, but this is what you need to go through the governing documents and know the document in detail. Rental restrictions are big, age restrictions, obviously, just a few of the ones that you want to be on the lookout for. common violations, what we've seen in the past few years, completion of common area, multiple projects come through our doors that the rec facility is not complete. No notice of completion. There has to be arrangement put in place before we'll go forward. Either the bond is expired, or the HOA hasn't gone after it, but this is one of the real problem areas that we've seen. Sales without a public report, another common violation that we've seen. And this one is especially bad for the subdivider because the consumer, without that public report, can sue years later to rescind the deal. So subdividers really want to be on the lookout for this one. Misrepresentation, material changes. Material changes are changes that are experienced in the subdivision, and the subdivider, by regulation, must notify the department, and it may or may not require an amended report. Bonding remedies for HOAs and cannot interpret the contract. The bonding remedies are typically that there is no bond in place, or it's expired, and or it's been released by the subdivider as the fiduciary of the HOA. That could get him placed in jail fairly easily. What you need to know, generally speaking, you need to know when I went over the list of what is a subdivision, if you're involved in subdivision sales, you need to know what constitutes a subdivision, five or more, if it's a common interest development. Doing that will cause you to ask the question of the subdivider, where's my public report? If you have any concerns or questions about this, please call the DRE at any time. Any one of my investigators can answer this question. The common interest governing documents, you need to review this. You need to know this document so you can do your due diligence in disclosing. And the public report. Read that public report when you get it in your hands. We had a violation just the other day where they were using the public report, but it was expired by a year. And so they made multiple sales under an expired public report. If you simply read the report, the expiration date's right on the cover, read the report and read every piece of information in there, because you're the ones that are on the ground. You know if it doesn't match up with what you're reading in the report. So if that is the case, call us right away, let the subdivider know, and we'll get an amended report out right away. Use of the accepted purchase agreement. As I mentioned earlier, we would review the purchase agreement. And so you have to use the DRE accepted agreement. So ask the subdivider about that. Make sure that that is the document you're using. Use caution with oral representations. We see this in the complaints that we receive. Not everything is contained in that contract. In a perfect world, it would be. So be very careful with the oral representations. And maybe place whatever you say in verbally in the contract. And then Civil Code Section 1368 has to do with common interest developments. And this is just the documents that must be provided. 1368 is in a resale transaction. For subdivision sales, it's Civil Code Section or BMP Section 11018.6. Generally speaking, the same items are required in both places. And there's the rest of the list of required documents. For more information, our website is the place to start. If these documents or these publications don't provide the information that you need, I have an office in LA, an office in Sacramento, and we'd love to talk to you anytime. Thank you very much.
Well, that's the end of our panel forum, and we'd invite you to ask any questions you might have. But before you do that, I just want to say a couple things. First, What Chris just said, I want to echo for everybody up here. We want to have ourselves be viewed by you as resources. We have the head of audits right here. We have the head of our subdivisions unit. We have the head of our legal unit to my left. We have our chief deputy. And then we have Tom Poole, who's right now over enforcement as well as licensing and examination. So if you have questions, please let us know. We want to be able to help you. We want to be a resource. Chris, we're glad to have him here today. As he said, he was here 3 years ago, and he's like one of these rock stars who only visits us every 3 years. And so I would invite you to put in your calendar for May 3, 2016, that Chris Neary will be back here. The other thing that we see a lot, just, you know, Chris was talking about the definition of a subdivision. It's five or more lots, units, or developments, five lots, units, or parcels. We see people who do what's called 4x4ing, and they play this little game, and they develop four, then another four, then another four. That is not lawful, and we will go after them for that. And just to underscore again, what we see is selling subdivision units without a public permit, using public reports that do not reflect the current condition of the project, and using a purchase contract that is different from that which was accepted as appropriate. The other thing that I want to just really emphasize here before we go into the question and answer session is the staffing that we currently have. I just did some math while Chris was up here talking, and between July 1, 2012 and March 31, 2013, his unit worked on 1,942 subdivision projects, and statewide they have a staff of just 38 folks, and that includes 8 people who just look at budgets. So that's a lot of work for that unit. And then Dan's unit has 30 auditors who are out in the field. John's unit has 16 administrative prosecutors. And we're trying, as I mentioned before, to shift resources as best we can to do the workload that we have. But it's a moving target right now because the market's shifting. We're seeing more examinations. We'll see more licenses soon. Chris's unit, we're shifting someone over to that unit right now. And we're just trying to figure out how to do the work that we do smarter and better and to improve our forms, to streamline where we can, and to figure out where we can focus and really get the best for public service. I mean, public protection and for public service. So with that, I'll open it up to questions. I'm going to sit down here, and we're going to answer the questions as a panel. I invite you to ask anything that you have on your mind. Tell us what we can do better or differently, or just share thoughts on the real estate market.
Yeah, Patrick Lee, Region 3. A quick question. When is the drop dead day for us to use a BRE number on our business card? Because some of us have the BRE number, they just order a couple thousand. Where is the absolute drop dead day that we must use the BRE number instead of a BRE number?
I'll just get up for a second and just tell you, there is no drop dead date. And you're talking about going from DRE to BRE? Okay, yeah. With the fraud that we've seen with 3,500 current investigations dealing with serious misconduct, 2,000 cases in our legal section, losses in property management, the fact that people do not have BRE on their cards is really not on the top of our list. You do not have to throw away your business cards. And the other thing that I want to share, in fact, can you move this to the next slide? One of the things that we've been talking a lot about at the department since I become commissioner is the fact that we don't want to treat certain conduct as conduct that merits administrative action. And what we've tried to do is focus on the behavior, and we're looking at whether someone is legitimate and honest and has tried to comply with the laws. If people have done that, we're talking right now, we're thinking about having a compliance unit rather than a prosecution unit for that. And so if you look on the board right there, we kind of have A, B, C, D, E, F. And it's kind of like the good and the bad and the ugly. And the A obviously is a gold standard. And B is good, C is average, and obviously
you see everything on a spectrum from just perfect practice to average practice, and then you see some people who may be negligent in what they do. But what we want to do is separate that from people who are dishonest, illegitimate, irreparable, who are violating the laws, willfully don't care about what we do. They're engaged in criminal conduct. That's where we want to focus our behavior, our efforts, whether it's in audits, whether it's in enforcement, and whether it's in legal. Because obviously our focus needs to be public protection. That's what we think we need to do for you. That's what we think we need to do for the public. And I think in order to really help us help you clear out the industry of bad players, that's where we need to focus. So people who are trying to comply with our laws, have the best intentions, may not be following those, we want to treat those people differently than people who are really not wanting to be compliant at all. So your question is a good one. We don't have a hard date at all on that. We know that people have a lot of stock in of business cards, and that's not something that we're going to be citing people for, and we're not going to be taking people's licenses away for that. So thank you for the question. Okay, yes.
Marion Norris, I'm from the Central Valley, and we're still in recovery. So on short sales, we're having auction companies interject themselves where they're no longer representing the bank or anyone else and asking people to execute listing agreements with them as well as the broker along with the seller. So At what point does an auction company continue to call themselves doing auction business? Right. And when you differentiate them becoming a brokerage, as they want to hold themselves harmless and let the right. broker and also make the agent become an employee of them as they hold a brokerage license at the same time. Because if that's allowable, then I want to hold multiple licenses too.
Mm-hmm. This is something that I've heard about from a few folks over the last couple days, and one of the things that we need to do as a department is get information from you on which of these companies, if you have
480 cases we're tracking.
Okay. And if you can give us information, in particular Tom Poole, we can open an investigation, we can see what they do. And obviously the key for us is looking at 10131 of the California Business and Professions Code to see if they're engaged in what we call licensed activity. If they are, they have to have a real estate broker's license.
They do. They have both.
Well, if they have a real estate broker's license and they're engaged in licensed activity, there is no violation of our law. And so the question becomes, where is the violation? That I guess I'm confused.
So I'm in a short sale.
Yes.
I'm the listing agent representing the seller. Mm-hmm. I'm going through the exercise of the short sale.
Mm-hmm.
6 months into it, just before short sale approval, I'm called by my lender and being told that the condition of my approval and the issuing of my letter is contingent upon my seller and my brokerage entering into agreement with auction.com. Does that help you?
That helps. Do you have any thoughts on that, Tom?
Yeah, lots of thoughts.
Because obviously, until we have the facts, and I'm glad you've shared this with us, we have no ability to really give an opinion or to...
I have seven files and 60 pounds of paperwork for you, Mr. Poole.
Is that on, Tom?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
All right, cool. What Commissioner was talking about, these are fact-driven cases. It's an interesting scenario because the lender, obviously you need its permission in order to go ahead with the short sale. So they're driving a conditions of a contractual arrangement. So the question is, from our perspective, is there anything that's in violation of the real estate law by them inserting themselves contractually into the contract? And the answer is maybe, maybe not. And obviously, you have a choice, your seller has a choice, is if they don't want to go with the terms of the contract, they're stuck. So So I don't have a clean answer for you. These cases are clearly fact-driven, and the question is whether or not is if this auction company, which is licensed, is doing anything that would be contrary to the real estate law. If it's pure contractually driven and there's nothing illegal about what's being asked, then it's just a bad scenario that's not going to be actionable by us. Having said that, as Commissioner said, if you want to get a hold of me, we'd be happy to look at particular cases and take a look at the facts behind them to see whether or not there's a violation of the real estate law.
Right. And just as a follow-up to that, there may be all sorts of causes of action that might be available in a civil litigation setting. But as Tom pointed out, we only have the real estate law and our regulations that we look at to see if we can take action against a licensee. For instance, if there's some kind of intentional interference with prospective economic advantage, negligent interference with prospective economic advantage, intentional interference with contract, that's nothing that we would look at, but it's something that could be pursued in a civil case. Also, you could take this up with the various lenders and object there, but we would look at the real estate law, commissioner's regulations, but we're willing to look at whatever you have, take an analysis of that, and then determine whether there's a violation that would warrant a discipline against a licensee.
Okay.
Go ahead.
There's an overriding type of behavior that may fall into what you're talking about, and that's called dishonest dealing or fraud. And so depending on the contractual relations and whether or not the lender is approving whatever's going on and whether or not somebody's hiding the ball from someone, that may certainly be grounds for discipline. But if nobody's hiding the ball, the lender knows what's going on, then Wayne's right. There's a civil cause of action called interference with beneficial economic relations. I don't know if you want to go there, but basically if no one's hiding the ball, everything's up front, the lender knows what's going on. And I don't know why the lender would throw a provision like this into you and say, we're not going to close this unless you let these people have a piece of the pie. I don't understand why that is. Yeah, but what's the lender getting from that? That's the part I don't understand.
They get paid for that.
They're getting like a kickback?
Yeah.
Well, the lender's in control of how this thing goes. And unless somebody's hiding the ball or lying about something, it is what it is.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. First of all, I'd like to thank you for providing this with such great information, but I'm going to switch gears here just a little bit. I'm a realtor changed to association executive, and right now we are having some issues with the DRE information, the records not being up to date. Therefore, that information for us, it really impedes the job that we have to do on a daily basis. In fact, right now we do the variable dues database that we're trying to get all of our members into compliance. And because the DRE information is not populated on a earlier basis, we cannot complete our data and our work.
Now, which information are you referring to?
Any records that are changed in DRE from status to someone from active to MBA,
okay,
or those kinds, okay, of issues right now feeding into a database that we're using. It's a huge encumbrance for us right now, and we're trying to get in compliance, but the records are not in sync. They're not coming in, okay, timely, and it's creating a huge burden for our
Tom has graciously said, I'll take that, and he's responsible for that. So.
I'll switch my hat from enforcement to licensing. So, first of all, I would encourage everybody to use our e-licensing system. It's a real, if you go online to change your broker to update your information via e-licensing, that's real time. So there shouldn't be any issue in that. And if the records aren't in sync, if you could just have your employees or the licensees go and adjust it via the e-licensing, it's a web-based adjustment, you're in the clear. So that's telling me these are records that are being sent in.
there are records that are being sent in,
yeah.
and those that are going to e-license.
Right.
Where the biggest issue is right now is the DRE information being able to sync with our compliance record.
So the it's not the issue with the e-licensing; it's the information that's being sent in. And as Wayne said, we're prioritizing and licensing. We do post on our website how long it's taking to actually process each type of application, whether it be a fictitious name, a change of a branch, or whatever. And that's running anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks. And that's just a matter of resources. So my takeaway in all this is that we need to have you all go through the e-licensing process, because that's real time in terms of updating our database. And I'll just have to apologize for the other. We're doing the best we can, given the limited resources that we have. But as far as I know, we're not more. Most of the types of transactions you're talking about are about 2 weeks when you're talking about paper applications, and in some instances, I know it's as much as 4.
Okay. That takes care of one component of it. It's the second component that is the most catastrophic for us at the association level, trying to get into the sync, is that we don't have the DRE information being synced with our database more than once a month, or even sooner than that, so that we can have the most current information.
Well, okay. It's interesting in terms of the other component. If you want to sync up with our database separately more than once a month, we might be able to work something out with our IT where your association could go in and update it more than once a month. Because you're talking about getting the
CDs. This is to the CAR syncing with DRE, with their information, we have and with DRE. That's where our issue is right
now. We could probably accommodate some sort of more than once a month update.
So who do we contact?
Me.
This man.
You. Okay.
It's tom.pool at dre.ca.gov.
That's a different issue. That's you're talking about getting CAR's information synced with ours, and that's an interface issue. So I think we could accommodate you to the point where it'll happen more than once a month.
Well, we appreciate your help, and on behalf of the other association executives,
the
sooner we can get this done, the happier we're all going to be. Thank you.
We have a special speaker here from CAR on this point. Stan Wigg.
Mr. Commissioner, Stan Wigg from CAR. Just on that point, our IT department has been in touch with Tom and with folks in your shop, and so they are working on a much
excellent,
more rapid
excellent.
Update on that.
Excellent.
I
thank you.
I don't know what the parameters are, but it's certainly more than once a month.
And I know the issue's come up a couple times, and we want to be more active as far as getting you updates quickly.
Yeah, so that is in process.
Excellent.
And it should be updated shortly.
Thank you. Yes,
Doug
sir.
Janke, Region 2. Two things. We have a recent revokee who lost his license but is still continuing to act as an agent.
Mm.
Who do you turn that person into?
Tom Poole.
Tommy!
I'll take that one. We're a regulatory body. We're an administrative body. We have the biggest hammer when the person has a license, and obviously we shot that bullet. We ended up with a revocation. The next step for us would be to issue a desist and refrain order if we could gather evidence that this person is still engaged in license activity. However, having said that, engaging in license acts without a license is a misdemeanor. It's something you could bring to a city attorney or a local DA. If it's egregious enough, they might be interested in taking it. But go ahead. That's something that we would be interested in. We just talked about issuing 213 desist and refrain orders last year, mainly to unlicensed individuals. So that's something that we could take in. But it also is a criminal offense that we can't prosecute but can be handled by the local district attorney.
Now, let me ask you a question. Have you referred this to a local prosecutor?
I just found about this down here from a fellow agent whose, shall we say, family member came across this person acting as an agent.
Now, do you know that the revocation is effective? Because sometimes the effective date is after the order has been signed. I'm just pointing that out there.
His license is gone. He's off your record.
The other thing I want to say, and this is hopeful for us,
us, after we become a bureau on July 1, the Department of Consumer Affairs has above it a Division of Investigation, and it is a mini police department, and they have a lot of tools that we don't have. They can issue arrest warrants. They can take people into custody. They can help us with search warrants. They've also committed to me that they will, in appropriate cases, issue notices to appear and arrest people who are engaged in unlicensed activity. After they've been warned about that unlicensed activity, after they've been given a desist and refrain order. So if this person is engaged in conduct that requires a license after the revocation, if you contact Tom, we can get a desist and refrain order issued. Then we will talk with the Division of Investigation and see what they can do. The best thing about a notice to appear in the absence of an actual arrest is it forces the person who receives that notice to appear to show up in a criminal court, and they have to enter a plea of guilty, not guilty, or nolo contendere right there. And I have seen many, many of these cases. Very rarely do they say not guilty because the guilt is obvious. If they enter a plea of not guilty, a jury trial is set. If they enter a plea of guilty or no contest, the judge says, based on that, I'm finding you guilty, and then they have a misdemeanor conviction above their head. And that's the one thing that we have been missing for a long time. It's the ability to have folks who violate our law suffer the consequences by having a misdemeanor conviction in their file. And this will help going forward. But if you could share the name with Tom, we'll see what we can do. And if you could also talk with the district attorney, in many counties, the DAs are very, very helpful, and they want to take out folks who had a license, no longer have that license, and continue to engage in conduct that requires a license. So thank you.
Number two, and this will require some group participation, so make sure you listen up. Before we're realtors, we're licensees. We're California state licenses with California state brokers. So my broker number is 014-666-77.
You get that down, Tom?
Yeah, please write it down, Tom. here's my scenario. I am a broker. You have a broker-agency relationship with your principal. You did not ask, nor did you request my presence in your relationship. Who feels that I have a legal right to be there without either of you requesting me to be there? By a show of hands, please raise your hand and say, that's honest, ethical, and legal.
Wait.
I'm a broker.
Yeah.
You have an agency relationship with a client.
Right.
You have an exclusive right to sell. No. You've got your own license. You can be Caldwell Banker, Keller Williams. I'm Joe Smith Real Estate. So you have a brokerage agency and a principal fiduciary relationship. How do you guys feel, and it's honest and ethical, that I can be inserted against the will of you and or your principal? Who feels that's a very valid place for me to be?
Inserted to do what?
Hold on. It sounds funny. Hold on.
Okay.
Thank you. We have thousands of years of experience in this building. Thousands. Not one person raised their hand to think that was a legal or ethical position for us to be in. And Marion brought up that exact scenario, and you guys could not answer that.
I'm asking
them if they think that's an honest legal position. Nobody raised their hands, and I just would like the DRE to look into it, because that's exactly the scenario that Marion laid out.
I disagree, and I'll tell you, here's why I disagree, is because you have a component where the lender has inserted into this contract and said that you need my permission in order for this sale to go forward. You're not going to get my permission unless you do X, Y, and Z. That's a contractual arrangement. You don't have to accept it. You can tell them to go away. Guess what? If you tell them to go away, you're not going to have the sale. But what's interesting about the short sales is that you have a lender inserting themselves into a transaction. In normal times, they would have no standing in the transaction. It would be between two principals. But the very fact that you have a lender that you need permission from is inserting themselves in the contract. And if you don't agree to those terms, that you
Not to interrupt, Tom, but my question is, and this gentleman's right here in my ear, so it's his fault. I'm blaming him. Agency. The question comes down to agency. What is the validity of our agency if we're going to allow it in one instance? No, be with me here. What's not to say that a Wells Fargo lender, I have a buyer that's got a buyer-broker relationship with me, agency signed, and the lender goes, but we have a Wells Fargo preferred buyer's agent that we want you to include in that process. My point is, and that's why I'm bringing it up, because you guys are the ones that we need guidance from, to be quite honest with you. Agency, please, if you don't have the answer, if you guys could look into it and let us know, that'd be great. But this is a question of agency. The short sale is not the question. It's the agency relationship that I'm concerned about.
Hand that down to John. Hand that down to John.
As Tom said, I think Tom said, there are three parties involved in the scenario. One of them, or actually four. You got the agent and the buyer. Then you've got the lender, and now you've got this auctioneer, or whoever that fourth party was.
Another brokerage was nothing more.
Whoever it is, trying to get in on the action. You've got the relationship between the buyer and the agent. That's a fiduciary relationship, that's for sure. And then you've got the lender. This isn't just a situation where you've got what you said earlier. Really, isn't like the other example, and that is you've
it's
got
exactly
two
the same. It's all about
you've
agency.
You've got two people together in an agency relationship, and some broker wants to come in and step in the middle of it. You left out the fact that there's a lender.
Well, I left out the fact that there's an agency relationship. You have a fiduciary duty to your principal that neither party to that contractual relationship wants or has invited this third-party brokerage, because at the end of the day, that's what the auction house is, it's a brokerage. So forget the name. It's a brokerage. It's just like I'm a broker. You may be a broker. You guys are kind of tying it to this one thing. If the bank doesn't want to approve the short sale, don't approve it. But inserting, my concern is, as an agent, folks, my concern is the ability and the legality of being able to insert a new brokerage in between an existing confidential fiduciary relationship. That's what I'm trying to get at. If they don't want to approve the short sale because it's not the right price, they want more money, that's fine. That happens. It's called the short sale process. Yeah. But inserting a new brokerage into that agency contractual relationship, what is the sanctity of our contract?
There's two types of legality going on here. There's the regulatory legality and the regulatory law, and that controls the relationship of the agent and the buyer. It doesn't control the relationship of anybody else. Unless you want to throw into the mix of regulatory law, there's this thing called fraud and dishonest dealing. That's the regulatory law. What you're talking about is you're talking about civil law, where somebody is interfering with a contract between the agent and the seller or the buyer.
Thank you.
That's the place where you really need to go. See, that scenario is not covered by the disciplinary or the regulation provided by DRE. It may be funky, it may be look like it's unethical, but it doesn't violate the real estate law.
And well, a local realtor or a local lawyer in Reading, who if I mention the name, you guys probably know who he is, very, very well respected, nationally respected, said it's torturous interference and went on through a commercial breach of contract.
That's right. That's what we're talking about. Those are civil causes of action.
Well, I know, but as a real estate licensee, isn't there something that the Department of Real Estate...
No. And I understand that you're looking for some guidance from us on this, but our law is the real estate law, and we also have the sub-dry lands law, the Vacation Ownership and Timeshare Act. We look to see whether there is fraud, misrepresentation, dishonest dealing. Now, what you're talking about is an agreement that you have either with a seller or with a buyer, and then you have a bank that's a necessary party to a short sale imposing its will on the deal. And they're saying, in order for us to approve the sale, you must do this. Now, you can walk away, or you can say, this doesn't seem right, and we're going to bring an action against you, bank, because you are intentionally interfering with our contract, or you're negligently interfering with our contract, or whatever other cause of action. And he used the term, tortious, but it's the same thing. It's intentional or negligent interference with a contract or with a prospective economic advantage. That is not something that the Department of Real Estate would initiate.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
John Hughes, Region 3. I have a question. You may say that this is the wrong place to have it, but in a short sale, a second says, we want more money than Fannie Mae is going to give us. If you pay us $10,000 early, we'll agree to their $6,000. You say, okay, well, that's fraud because you're getting this off HUD. Clearly, nobody's made a payment on it in a year, so it's obvious that that money is only for the purpose of the short sale, and your second negotiator says, well, that's what my supervisor says, so it must be okay. How do we deal with that? I've even sent copies of a DRE article, of our CAR articles, but nothing specific about that instance, and they keep saying, hey, that's the way it's going to be.
Yeah, short sale fraud is very hard for us to prove. It's very difficult to prove out there in the real world as well. We know it's happening a lot. We know that there are Confederates involved in some of these deals. We know that there's straw buyers. We know that monies are being paid outside of escrow. We know that monies are being paid to sellers when they're not supposed to be. And what we need are whatever facts you have, whatever proof you have, and we need witnesses who will say this is what happened.
Okay, and what if I've been good and every time I've had a discussion I've sent a fax that says this is what you told me and I disagree with it, which I did,
mm-hmm.
to basically document a conversation
right.
that they would otherwise
right.
duck.
Right.
Is that any use to you?
It would be of use to us. The difficulty continues to be that we don't have many live witnesses. We're not getting the cooperation from the lenders that we'd like to see. And so we have a number of investigations into short sale fraud cases, and we've taken action in some of them, but they're very, very difficult to prove. Because, and in many cases, everybody says, well, we all knew about this, so there's total transparency. There's no loss here. And we need to find a violation of one or more of our rules or regulations. So whatever you can get us, we'll look at it and see if we can make a case out of it.
Who should I speak to?
Tom Poole.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Sarah Heck, Region 30. I actually have two situations and questions. One of them is regarding auction.com, and I know you said that most of this is going to be a civil matter. What about the pay that they're receiving? They're a licensed broker doing licensed activity, not receiving commission. They're receiving a 5% premium. There's got to be something with regard to their agency, what they're signing or not having signed, and the funds that they're receiving.
And again, this we've not looked at before. We've
heard, would that be a DRE issue rather than a civil?
It could be, depending on what they're doing and how they're doing it. Now, obviously, we don't get involved in commission structures and how people get paid. But if, like John said, if there's fraud or dishonest dealing, or there's some kind of kickback, secret commission, secret payment, we'll look at that. But if it's all disclosed, if it's transparent, if somebody says this is what they're doing and this is what we're going to pay them for it, there's nothing that we can do. The other thing is, and the question I have, are they acting as an auctioneer or are they acting as a broker? Because it sounds like they may be using two hats. And I just don't know. I don't have any of the facts. And it's something that we would look at. In fact, I would ask Tom again if he could look. It's auction.com. I hear the name over and over again. And so that's, pardon? It's called BizHub. BizHub at auction.com and auction.com. Okay. We can look at that and look at their website, see what they say. But as John and Tom said, if you have a lender that says, this is who we want you to use, you can walk away from the deal or you can file some kind of action against the lender and the auction house if you feel that there's a breach of your contract, interference with that contract, or interference with prospective economic advantage.
Okay. And then the next one, I'm not sure if this is the forum to bring it up in, but they told us to come here. There's a website called Neighborhood Cities. And it's an agent rating system. And any one of you guys can go on and look yourself up and look and see if any of the information is correct. We had almost every agent in our office do it. And the data that they're displaying is incorrect. And they're rating you and telling you, so any consumer can go on and it will say why you're subpar. Or you can pay them and all of a sudden your rating can go up. In addition to this, if you have a client who Googles your name and your name pops up or their website pops up first, we have a situation where one of our agents got a referral from neighborhoodcity.com. Their client Googled their name, clicked on the Neighborhood City, clicked on that. It came through as a phone call, as a referral, I'm sorry, from Neighborhood City, where the agent had just, you know, kind of went through the disclosures, or I'm not exactly sure with all of the details, but at the end of the day, the agent agreed to a 30% referral fee of essentially the broker's commission because everything was sent through neighborhoodcity.com. So this we have a lot of this coming up in our area with two separate issues. One of the issues is that they're incorrectly rating agents, and the second issue is that then if your client finds your information through their website, they're charging a 30% referral and having the agent, not the broker, sign that referral. And then if the broker were to say, well, it's my commission, you didn't have me sign anything, they're pursuing that agent. They're suing the agent for the agreement, and they have a very strong set of attorneys behind them that are saying, yeah, we'll just go after the agent because they agreed to it, whether or not they got any of that commission.
I have never heard of this entity, and I have a couple questions for you. Do you know if it's in California alone, just California, or everywhere? Because I'd like to know the scope of it.
It's a Bay Area, but when you go to their website, it's run by a Bay Area brokerage.
Has anyone here written to them to challenge the rating that you've gotten? Because I'm troubled by this rating system that seems to be bogus.
I'm not an expert, but I can give you a little bit of background. They are licensed real estate brokers in the state of California. However, they do practice in other states. They, as far as we've been able to ascertain, they only act as referral company. They do not buy and sell. They don't represent buyers or sellers. They are strictly referral. Their claim is that they have a certain criteria formula for coming up with this rating, and that rating cannot be challenged because they follow that rating formula on every agent. And the information that they use for that rating is gleaned from websites such as Yelp, Zillow, those things. Mm-hmm. It's based on the number of sales that have been reported and whatever. In most cases, they are not vendors of MLSs, so they're not getting the MLS information to put that into their formula. And my understanding is that there's, I don't know, maybe a half dozen or so litigations ongoing nationwide.
Suing them, I hope?
No, them suing MLS.
This is intriguing to me. There are a bunch of lawyer rating services, and most lawyers couldn't care less about the service because most clients don't look at those. How much is this entity being tapped as far as people looking at the ratings there?
I don't know. This is a newer issue that's come up in our area, but one of the examples, because we did all look ourselves up, we have an agent that's here with us that's a car director on our board of directors, been an agent for 22 years, has a 45% rating, and it says that she's closed 13 deals. So I don't know how big of and a correction, it's neighborhoodcity.com, not city.
Neighborhoodcity.com. John, you have a thought?
Between an organization such as this and Yelp, who might put out negative ratings for anybody at all, is that this organization has a real estate broker license. Therefore, there is a violation of the real estate law for a real estate licensee who does something that amounts to fraud and dishonesty, not within a real estate transaction, but outside of it completely. And so if we can get the proof and prove it in administrative law court that this organization is putting out information that is either false, they know it's false, or they have no reason to believe that it's true, then that would amount to, in my opinion, fraud and dishonest dealing, and we could probably discipline their license for that.
And it sounds like they're putting out this false and fraudulent information with the expectation of getting some listing. So whatever information you can share,
I think that they're doing it for the listings. I think that they're doing it because for the referrals, they refer it out, and then you can. They also, I would assume, you could, as an agent, you can climb the ranks and enhance the ratings with their.
But we can definitely investigate this, see what they're doing, see about their formula, and look at their ratio, figure out what they're doing, and then figure out the best way for us to take disciplinary action if we can.
You know, the motivation for their doing it is not as important as what they're doing. So really it doesn't matter if they're doing it for referral, if they're doing it for money. If it's dishonest and they're representing that it's something that it's not, then that's a violation of 101.77J of the BNP code.
Thank you.
So if one or more of you can share the information with Tom Poole, we can undertake an investigation and see what's going on with this entity and then determine whether we have enough evidence to take disciplinary action against their license. Yes, ma'am.
Junia Painter, Madera County, Region 12. And I'm just going to add to what Neighborhood City Information has been giving out here. They do have a rating system, and I did one transaction with them. How they get the clients to go to the website, they market it heavily, and they offer buyer incentive. The buyer will get a percentage of the commission received back as a rebate as soon as the escrow closes or as soon as they get the referral check back from the buyer's agent. They only do referral as for buyers, and a lot of buyers are lured to their website because they pay a lot of money to be on the top or the front page on any search engine. I did that. I am a broker, so when I received the referral agreement, fee was 30%. It was a client that I never had dealt with before. Mm-hmm. So I did go ahead and do it, and I did like that they were going to get some money back. I believe the total commission paid to me was about $1,900. They got about $400 of it, which was great. But the rating, how it was, is I had no rating, and they gave me, the client gave me raving reviews, so my rating is excellent. I don't have an issue with it. However, that's how they rate agents. And where the number of transactions that they did, where they got the information from is unknown to me because I had a certain amount of transactions on the assets. Didn't bother me if they were accurate or not because I don't think, it mattered to me at that time. So it is, they do pay a buyer's, if the buyer contacts them via email or on their site, they will refer them to whatever agents they have reached out to and have an agreement to, or if they don't have anyone in an area, they will reach out and say, would you like to be a preferred agent of ours? And then the client gets, contacted by the agent, and they have to buy the property to the buyer, which there's nothing wrong with it. But the buyer will do it because they'll get a rebate that comes out of the referral fee paid by the buyer's agent.
And do I understand from listening to this that you can pay them money to get a better rating?
You can place advertising just like you would on Realtor.com or Zillow.
Mm-hmm.
I do not believe, because I had excellent rating, but I didn't give them a dime other than the referral fee.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have a rating until the client actually rated me. Mm-hmm. And I had, I don't know how many stars or whatever, and I was happy about it. I haven't looked at my profile lately, but I will see if it's gone down or up or anything. But I don't believe it affected my rating, whether I paid the advertising or not.
Thank you for bringing it to our radar and putting it on our radar so we can look at that. It's a strange situation. I'm troubled by the rating system, and it sounds very unusual to me. So we'll look into it and see what we can do.
The reason why I got up to address you was about the auction.com.
Mm-hmm.
The seller has to sign the agreement and be in that okay with the bank or lien holder to put the property on auction.com.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they have a listing agreement with any brokerage, the lien holder has approached the seller and said, if you allow us to, if you reach into agreement with auction.com,
mm-hmm.
you will receive, let's say, a $5,000 up on the close of escrow. That is going to be paid out of the proceeds from auction.com. Mm-hmm. So a seller is motivated to do that.
Sure.
But, you know, it's an agency. You have an agency with the seller.
Right.
And your duty is to do the best for your client.
That's
so
right.
If I'm representing the seller and my seller was sold, I don't like it because we
right.
already have,
right.
you know, a transaction going and accepted offer, and that might be overridden by
right. Right.
The auction.
Right.
But it's my duty to do what's best for the seller, and the seller has the choice to say no. But most sellers are not going to say no if the lien
right.
holder is telling them that instead of getting just a half, they're going to get more money.
Yeah.
You know.
You're
so
absolutely right, and just to repeat what was said here.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, when there's a seller agent agreement, you're supposed to put the seller's interest first. You're doing the best you can. And then some third party walks in and says, here's the deal.
Yeah.
And there looks like there may be some kind of interference, but it's nothing that we can take action on under our law.
And we don't like it. I'm not fond of it. But when you listed the short sale, you knew that the lien holder would have a say in terms and
yes.
anything.
Yes.
And they're not making the seller put it on auction.com.
Yes.
The
yes.
seller is saying, yes, if you're
yes.
going to give me something, I will sign the agreement, and the instructions are sent to the listing agent, even though he has it on the MLS, put it on auction.com. The catch was the amount put on auction.com was less than the listing agreement,
mm-hmm.
but that's how the auction
mm-hmm.
part of it kicked
mm-hmm.
in. And they, you know.
Right. Right.
Just wanted to clarify.
Thank you very much. And we have one more question, and then we'll thank you again for coming to our forum and for participating. Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon, and thank you for all the work you do. Rebecca Sally, Region 4. We just looked up neighborhoodcity.com. They get it from the DRE because my name is different, and it's only my license name. So
when you say they get it from the DRE...
My name is Rebecca Sally, but my license is Rebecca O. Sally,
okay, yeah.
And that's what Neighborhood City has.
So, I mean, just in responding to that, obviously our license records are public records. So they either have purchased a list of real estate licensees in the state, or they go through our list, and then they use that name, they use the address that we have, and I understand. Okay. Thank you very much. Well, I want to thank you for attending our DRE forum. Thanks for the questions. We appreciate it, and we'll see you in October in Long Beach. Thanks.